chosen to call my talk Data, Information, Knowledge and the Telegraph, and then there's a subtitle. It says Three Eclectic Episodes Illustrating Their Relation. Now, as an introduction, societies and cultures depend, and I think that will be shared in this room by almost everybody, they depend on shared knowledge. For instance, about different social roles, positions, about norms and behaviors associated with these roles, about rights and duties, shared values, or even something as large and indefinable as a common cultural heritage, to name but a few examples. In order to be shared, knowledge, on the one hand, needs to circulate within a specific group, and on the other hand, of course, knowledge or bits and pieces thereof is also constantly exchanged without other such groups, purposefully or not. Hence, knowledge, willingly or not, is constantly on the move. And as knowledge only qualifies as knowledge, as long as it is known by somebody, it can only, and that's, I think, a very, very crucial thing, it can only continuously exist in communication. And this also leads us to a question that we have circumvented so far, but if you have a book, like this book here on the table, and if this book is in a library and nobody really has ever read it, or the people who have read it are long dead, does the content qualify as knowledge or not? Well, I don't provide an answer right now, but for the purpose of my talk, I would say probably not, because knowledge is only knowledge if it's really actively known by someone. Thus, knowledge is constantly communicated and passed on from person to person, from society to society, from culture to culture, if you will. And of course, it permanently changes its nature in this particular process. This is because communication is a mediated process. It needs to rely on some form of carrier, material or immaterial. Such carriers are always limited, always, in suitability and capacity. And therefore, knowledge cannot, we had it already about that, therefore knowledge cannot be passed on in its entirety, and neither can it be received and identically replicated. The tiny piece of communicated knowledge always alloys with other available knowledge and is thus transformed. So that's my concept of the transformation of knowledge. It happens mainly when pieces of knowledge, something that I will in a second call information, is communicated. And what follows from this? It follows that two persons can never know the same, no matter which medium has facilitated the communication between these two people. But still, different media foster very different transformations in the knowledge that is communicated. They have what I call rationales that alter, limit, or widen the array of choices that an actor, in our case a communicator, has. And while not invested with agency themselves, they can, like the media, thus directly impact on the nature of knowledge and information. Especially in a historical context, however, the concrete ways in which media can unfold such powers remain mainly obscure. Therefore, this paper will try to shed some more light on the issue by looking at specific historical examples, in our case that of the Telegraph, and its influence over 19th century exchanges of knowledge. With the help of three, as I said, very eclectic episodes, but nevertheless very concrete historical examples, it shall be demonstrated how exactly the use of a new medium could question and transform established forms of knowledge. But before we come to this, let me just briefly discuss what we, or what I, mean when we speak about knowledge, what happens to it when bits of it need to be communicated, and of course how telegraphy comes in the picture in this particular context. Now, just some words on data, information, and knowledge, like the three first constituents of my title. I'll come back to a very important publication by Peter Perk, who published in 2000 a classical historical study on knowledge, and he opens it with the following passage, and I quote here: "Today, we are living, according to some sociologists, at least, in a knowledge society, or an information society, dominated by professional experts and their scientific methods. According to some economists, we live in a knowledge economy or information economy marked by the expansion of knowledge-producing or knowledge-disseminating occupations." End of quote. Just for explanation, that was also in the quote. Yeah. While Burke himself, of course, is aware of the particular relation between information and knowledge, the two introductory sentences that I just quoted, they replicate quite well how interchangeably these two terms, information and knowledge, have been and, very much to my dismay, are still used in colloquial or even academic parlance. Information and knowledge are not the same, and that's very important. And accordingly, there's a significant difference between styling current Western societies mainly as either information or knowledge-driven. Yet, of course, these two concepts, they are closely related, and in order to be able to better distinguish between the two terms, to better see the differences, and to better judge the possible consequences of prioritizing either the one or the other, some more attention must be given to the nature of their relation, and thus to the question of how exactly they interact and how their interaction provides a point of contact at which outside factors, and that's basically where I come in, where outside factors can impact on processes of communication. For the purpose of clarifying their relation, I'll take the liberty of nicking a concept that's been developed in knowledge management, basically, and which is rather unusual to use in either historical sciences or, I think, any other cultural science, but we'll see in a second. So the concrete nature of these relations has, for instance, been discussed, and that's the concept that I've just mentioned, in the so-called data, information, knowledge, and wisdom hierarchy, the DIKW hierarchy. Yeah? And this is in wide use in the domains of, for instance, information science or knowledge management. This model has been developed to a certain degree of sophistication in the 1980s, but its roots refer back as far back as to the 1920s and 1930s. One such very early source of inspiration that is cited in almost every publication about the hierarchy is T.S. Eliot's 1934 work, The Choruses from the Rock. And the first stanza of this poem starts with the following lines, and I quote here, and I'll add some drama, if that's okay. Where is the life that we've lost in living? Where is the wisdom that we've lost in knowledge? And where is the knowledge we've lost in information? End of quote. Some drama, not too much. The use of the term hierarchy, of course, suggests that there is some element that is superior or more valuable than others. The model implies a form of an evolutionary development from the simplest omnipresent form of data via the intermediary stage of information and knowledge to the eventual achievement sometime of wisdom. And this evolutionary ladder can be climbed by ascribing meaning to data. You ascribe meaning to data, that becomes information. Then you connect information to other information, it becomes knowledge. Then you finally understand the why behind the knowledge and you gain wisdom. So that's the general explanation of this particular hierarchy. The implicit value judgment about the status of data, information, knowledge, and wisdom might be of a certain degree of use in the domain of knowledge management, where this hierarchy has developed. But if we try to understand and explain the relation between data, information, and knowledge from a socio-cultural perspective, and that's basically what we're doing here, I think, such an artificial gradient, such an artificial valuing, might obscure more of the details than it can actually enlighten. Here, each element, as for us, each element is of different relevance in a very different context, and it can thus not be valued more or less than the other. The particular characteristics of the different elements and their relations as described in this DIKW hierarchy. This is one acronym that's not particularly useful, I think, because it's very long. So as described in the DIKW hierarchy can, however, be useful in order to clearly define how data becomes information, how information becomes knowledge, and knowledge eventually becomes wisdom, although we'll skip that part here in a second. Why? The model exists in several different versions. So maybe to just sum up, what I'm trying to say is that I think this particular hierarchy is useful to a certain degree for us as well, as long as we skip the hierarchy part. Yeah? It does explain a lot about the relations between the individual constituents, but what I don't like about it is that, of course, if you use it in knowledge management, something, or a science that is very much concerned with efficiency also, yeah? You, of course, need to have a hierarchy. But for our purposes, to insert a hierarchy between data, information, and knowledge is, well, not very useful. I think it's an artificial valuing system that does no good to our purposes. So that's basically what I wanted to say. I think in that, I'll leave it at that. I'll skip the part where I'm tried or where I wanted to explain different versions of this particular hierarchy, and I'll just come to one description. Or let's suffice it to say that different authors had very, very different ideas of intermediary stages in the data information knowledge hierarchy. They inserted stuff, understanding, for instance, between knowledge and wisdom, so you need to understand knowledge before you can gain wisdom. Another author said, no, in the end, wisdom is not the highest stage. In the end, there is enlightenment, the point in time when you understand absolutely everything, and stuff like that. This is very interesting philosophically, but for our purposes, maybe not very efficient. That's why I skipped this part, but I cannot skip reciting from one particular very concise summary of how these particular parts of the hierarchy relate to each other, and that's where I'm going to kind of build my telegraph narrative on later. Now, this comes from a publication from Paul Gamble and John Blackwell, and they focus exclusively on the four core categories: data, information, knowledge, and wisdom. And this is what they have to say on their relationship. I quote: data refers to chunks of facts about the state of the world. Data may be either quantitative or qualitative in nature. Information. Classically, information is defined as data that are endowed with meaning and purpose. A slight difficulty here is that people may not agree on the meaning. Knowledge. Information connected in relationships may be described as knowledge. At the individual level, a person can relate information to his or her external environment, or groups of people can agree how to interpret new information. Wisdom. When knowledge has been put into action repeatedly on the basis of interpretation and relationships, and when it is produced, when it produces reliable and consistent results, it becomes second nature. Wisdom is the ability to make sound judgments and decisions apparently without thought. End of quote. So this is very neatly kind of compartmentalized. That's what we talk about. Data, this is what we talk about when we talk about information, and so on, and so on. Now, why is this important for us? Here we look at the question of how particular media, in our case, the case of the telegraph, can influence the phases of transition between these different stages of the model. In this regard, the first two phases of transition from data to information and from information to knowledge, and vice versa, and the other way around, they provide particular purchase for media and their rationales. Therefore, our focus in the following will rest only on data, information, and knowledge and their particular interrelations. Because in order to be shared, and I've already said that, knowledge needs to be communicated. Processes of communication, however, are usually identified as the transmission of information, not of knowledge. Only parts of one's knowledge can effectively be communicated. And in the process of communication, these parts first need to be selected, like which parts of my knowledge do I communicate, and they need, in this process, they are necessarily decontextualized. They are turned into information that, in the act of communication, loses all prior associations and connections to other information contributing to the knowledge of the communicator. Communication is a mediated process, so this means that the exchange of decontextualized information needs a carrier, a particular medium, be it language, be it the telegraph, be it the email, whatever, be it sign language, you name it. Yeah? So countless such carriers come to mind, but none of these carriers can transmit information as is. Yeah? Rather, information needs to be encoded in symbols of different forms, that can be handled, stored, and transported by the particular medium of choice. So they need to be encoded and decoded again. And of course, and this is what, it's been implicitly there all the time, different media have very different rationales that necessitate or that at least foster the use of a particular set of symbols in a particular way over other possible alternatives. This often privileges some aspects of information, of information transmission, over other aspects, some kinds of information over others. And assuming that the communicator knows about the particular rationale of a medium, it also affects the selection of particular bits of information from a pool of knowledge. Ideally, information will be selected and prepared for communication in a way that suits the particular rationale of the medium that you've picked out for communication. So, processes of communication entail at least four phases of such transition, during which knowledge is encapsulated in information, knowledge, information. Information is encoded in symbols, it becomes data, then you communicate it, and then it's decoded again into information, and information is recontextualized in the knowledge of the recipient. And these four, or sometimes even more, phases of transition, they constitute the interfaces where media, and of course several other outside factors that I cannot go into detail here, they can influence the transmission of information and thus the sharing of knowledge. As a consequence, these are the interfaces where knowledge and society, where knowledge and culture interact very, very actively. To look in some more detail at the question of how exactly individual media insert themselves and their rationales in these four transitions will accordingly allow us to better understand which role specific media play in the circulation of knowledge and how they can be central in the transformation of information and knowledge without having agency of their own, and that's very important. In the following, these questions shall be discussed on the basis of telegraphic communication in the 19th century, and this is what I can say, enter the telegraph. The very idea that you can use electric current to convey information has been around since about the middle of the 18th century. In 1743, I think it was, an anonymous writer, he was signing only with his initials C.M., he described, and I quote, an expeditious method of conveying intelligence in the Scots Magazine. And the method that he described built on the knowledge that was around about electricity and so on at that particular point in time. So what he actually described was the following. You should have, I think it was 26 individual wires, and the frictional machines or something kind of, what's the word for that? The turner wheel, basically, in order to produce frictional energy that can be discharged. And if you want to transmit an A, for instance, or a B or whatever, you discharge this frictional energy, send it over the wire A, which then produces, what's the word for that? Static attraction or something like that? I don't know. You know what happens to your hair when you when you rub a balloon. So it produces a kind of electric attraction that then attracts like tiny pieces of paper that are very light in weight. They are attracted to the ball, and that indicates to you, A. So you do this a couple of times or a couple of more times around, and you might even be able to transmit a word. So you see that this is very, very impractical. It's been reconstructed in a Berlin exhibition, I think, a couple of years ago as a kind of an artist or an art exhibition as a kind of showcase on how complicated distance communication could be. But it's pretty obvious that it would have worked in theory, but practically well. But this was the time when the idea first got into the heads of people. And then scientists like Luigi Galvani or Alessandro Volta, or a little bit later Hans Christian Ørsted and Michael Faraday, entered the stage and made their particular little contributions to the science, to the understanding of electricity. And from then on, the idea to use electricity to convey information evolved and evolved. And you can say, I think, that the particular breakthrough, scientifically speaking, was achieved around the year 1820 when Oersted discovered electromagnetism. So, I mean, you'll know the concept that if you treat electricity in a particular way, let's put it like that, you can produce something like an artificial magnetic field. And that, of course, is much more useful to attract things than static energy. That's much more exact and so on. If you think of Morse telegraphy, for instance, like the Morse tap keys and so on, they basically worked with electromagnetism. So around 1820, this concept's been discovered and put into practical application. That was the point in time when experiments with telegraphy really, really took off and got going. Loads of early apparatuses were built around that time that used different such settings. Many of them worked a little bit, so you could transmit stuff, but it was not very practical to use them really for communication. Others, however, they learned from these early apparatuses. And people, for instance, like Samuel Finley Breeze Morse and his assistant Alfred Weil on one side of the Atlantic, namely in the US. You've certainly heard about Morse, of course. I mean, he usually is styled as the inventor of telegraphy. But then it's sometimes forgotten that at the other side of the Atlantic, namely in the UK, we had Wheatstone and Cook. So William Cook and Charles Wheatstone, like one the typical entrepreneur scientist pair, so one very business-minded person who kind of provided the money and the impetus, and another person who was very interested in the scientific details. They paired up and also came up with their particular idea of how you could use electricity for information transmission. Both of these parties worked on different sides of the Atlantic on a proper telegraph, and they came up with reasonably well working ideas in the year 1837, and really out of pure coincidence they made showcases or public demonstrations of their technology they had invented within only a couple of months, parallel to each other basically. Very, very different designs, but both of them worked. That was in 1837. Everyone was deeply impressed, but for a long time nothing happened, because for a very practical reason, it was nice to see that you could transmit stuff, information, via electricity, but it was entirely unclear how you could use this in everyday life in a way that would justify the massive cost that it did load on the shoulders of people who would like to use it. So it took a couple of years, exactly I think 5 years, until Morse on the one side of the Atlantic had lobbied Congress enough to get some funds to build an experimental line between Washington and Baltimore. So that was, I think, building that started in 1842 and it was finally finished in 1844 and went into operation then. So that was on the one side of the Atlantic. Very untypically for the US, you had public money spent there on something like that. In the UK, it was rather different. The UK government made it very clear that, these things, these are private endeavors, we don't mingle with that. So you see where you get your money for experimental lines from. And what Cook and Wheatstone did is they went to the railway companies, like, 1830s, 40s, railway boom. Railways were expanding and railway networks were coming into existence. So they went to the railways and said, we have this little new technology here, you think you can use that? And it took some lobbying, but it actually caught on. And they, after some convincing, Cook was able to convince a couple of railway companies to let him erect telegraph lines next to their railroad tracks. And that's very important, and why I'll explain in a second. Let's for the moment just suffice it to say that this marks the breakthrough of the technology and the kind of public acceptance of this new technology coming about, say, in the middle of the 1840s. The system then expanded, and it also started to expand internationally. In the early 50s, the first connection via a larger stretch of ocean was made, namely over the British Channel, the English Channel between Dover and Calais. A cable was laid there in the year 1851 that permanently connected France and Great Britain. Only a couple of years later, other cables followed in the Mediterranean, across the North Sea, stuff like that. In 1865, the technology had evolved to a point that for the first time in their history, India and Europe could be directly connected via telegraphy, and only 1 year later, 1866, so this is usually the date that you get when you speak about international or global telegraphy, the transatlantic cable came into existence. It had been in place a couple of years before, but it worked only for 3 or 4 weeks until the connection broke down. But in 1866, a permanent connection was established, and that marks like the big, you know, symbolic date of the telegraph going properly global, one could say. Now, what's the reason for this? So, as you can see, I mean, it started off in the 1840s, and then 20 years later, in the year 1870, the latest, you really have a proper international global network going. So that's merely 25 years. That's a very, very short span of time, and we'll have to look at why this has happened in such a short time span. And the reason for that can be found in one little fact, I think. Usually when people try to find out what's so special about telegraphy, they say, well, of course, I mean, it's pretty obvious, isn't it? Everything went so much faster. Yeah? You want to transmit a message from London to Calcutta, you just do it, and it's there in, I don't know, 30 minutes or something like that. So it's fast, it's good, it's useful. This is, of course, true, but it's only half of the story, and I don't think that this is really the distinguishing marker. I would call this absolute acceleration of communication. But what I think is much more important is the relative acceleration of communication that you get with the telegraph. And that's the point where I get back to the railways. The central reason why the railways had an interest, or after some reluctance discovered their interest in telegraphy, was that, again, for reasons of cost and money saving and economy, of course, many, many railways in the UK and elsewhere, they had built a single track railway network, basically. So from A to B, you had one track, and you used this track in two directions. Slightly impractical, but luckily, every couple of kilometers, or a bit further apart, every couple of 10, 15 kilometers probably, you had a part where you could, you know, where the single track split up for a short track in two tracks, and two trains could pass. Now, in a time without cell phone communication, internet, email communication, without telegraphy and so on, you can imagine that it was pretty difficult to coordinate two trains that were running in opposite directions, because the train as such was the fastest means of communication. So there was simply nothing, I mean, apart from carrier pigeons and stuff like that, but you couldn't use that for railway coordination. But apart from that, there was nothing faster than the train. So how to coordinate trains? This was a massive problem that caused clog-ups of the system and delays and you name it. So with the telegraph, the railway companies for the first time had the means in their hands to coordinate their trains, have an exact timetable, and be economical at the same time. And that gave the breakthrough. So you see, what happened was actually a relative acceleration. For the first time, you had a communication means that separated communication from transport, and thus became a control instrument for steamships, railways, you name it. So it's the control element that became the unique sales point of telegraphy, basically. Now, so why is that? It's because the telegraph encoded information that was to be transmitted in a pattern of electric impulses, and thus it dematerialized it. Information transmission was thus freed from a number of, and I call this Newtonian physical constraints, from which all material movement that we know suffers. The carrier of dematerialized information does not have a mass, if we for a moment forget the very, very, very small mass of moving electrons. It is thus not limited by what I would call physical inertia. There are, of course, other limitations though. Electric current, for instance, needs a conductor through which it can travel. And this conductor needs to be, it has to be put in place before you can send something and before information can be transmitted. And accordingly, criteria such as geographical proximity or topography, for instance, distance, they still at least initially play some role in dematerialized communication. And of course, electric current encounters electrical resistance, for instance. But these limitations, they are very different from the limitations that material transport in railways, in carriages, in whatever, encounters. And the dematerialization of information transmission, on which the telegraph thrives in many ways, has, of course, and that's a central point of what I'm trying to say, a strong bearing on the relation between data, information, and knowledge. The telegraph transmitted information as a series of electric impulses, and sometimes this has been interpreted as an early binary system, like 0 and 1, in the sense that there was either current or there was no current. In fact, however, most of the systems that we know, the Morse system or the Cook and Wheatstone needle system, they knew three essential states. In the case of Morse telegraphy, there was either no signal, or a short impulse, a dot, or a long impulse, a dash. That's not a binary system. It's a system with three stages. And the same goes for the Cook-Wheatstone needle telegraph. And with this, you encoded, with these three possible states, you encoded the information that had to be transmitted. Both Morse and the needle code, they used a Roman alphabet and its bases. The letter could not be, both systems could not accommodate all the letters in the first version. So not even all the letters that we know were in there. In any case, Roman letters were associated with combinations of impulses that first needed to be encoded and later decoded. And that means, and that's very important, that a plain text piece of information that needed to be transmitted, and it had thus already been encoded in language, because we can't forget that intermediary step. It had to be further encoded in a series of electric impulses. And in so doing, only the plain letters could be transmitted. Nothing more, nothing less. Any additional information resting in, for instance, the handwriting, in manual corrections in the margins, for instance, in the kind of paper that you use, or even something as pathetic, and I hope you excuse the example, as lipstick on a love letter, for instance. Yeah? You cannot transmit this. What you can transmit via the telegraph is the plain letters, full stop, end of story. And even more importantly, the relatively complicated encoding of letters in electric impulses produced very lengthy impulses, impulse patterns, even if only a very short message was to be transmitted. And this, of course, it clogged up wires, and as a consequence, it was very, very expensive for the sender. Therefore, the telegraph rewarded brevity in expression. The information to be sent should be very much to the point. It should be stripped of linguistic ornaments and unnecessary remarks. Grammar and punctuation were mostly thrown overboard. And in international business correspondence, code books were compiled that added one more layer of encoding to the relation between data and information. For instance, I'll give you an example here. There's the very widely used ABC telegraphic codebook. It's like a book of that size. And for instance, if you transmit the word aigulet, I spell it, A-I-G-U-L-E-T, it's an artificial word, it doesn't exist, it's something made up. Huh? You take up the book, look it up, and the aigulet, and then it says there, and I quote, is not likely to affect you in any manner. No story. Or you look up bluster, and it means, and I quote, the boxes were delivered in bad order. End of quote. Yeah? So you had a full book with all these abbreviations. So another layer, and that's why I'm saying this, it's yet another layer of encoding. So you had language, Roman letters. You encode this in impulses, and then you put another code layer about it. And all of this, of course, influences how you compose telegrams. And a widely used booklet of guidelines, so the businessman of the 19th century got a booklet with guidelines, if you use the telegraph, please do it like this. And one of these booklets says, and I quote, Naturally, there's a right way and a wrong way of wording telegrams. The right way is economical, the wrong way is wasteful. If the telegram is packed full of unnecessary words, words which might be omitted without impairing the sense of the message, the sender has been guilty of economic waste. End of quote. So it even goes as far as one very prominent American businessman in the 19th century making a very complicated calculation how much public and private money could be saved if telegraph users in America would eventually accept that the word please is an utter economic waste. So he calculated that by just skipping the word please in composing telegrams, you could save millions and millions of money. Yeah? Luckily, however, this suggestion was never really put into practice, and the word please has survived in at least most communications that we know. Now, why am I telling all of this? I mean, this need for brevity affected both the relation between data and information on the one hand, and also that between information and knowledge. Regarding the former, very, very small mistakes in the encoding and decoding process that would previously either have gone completely unnoticed in letters, yeah, or would not have occurred and been rectified by the context that you provide in a letter, for instance, they could now completely distort the message. And I'll give you a very well-known example here as well. It comes directly from an anecdote collection, 19th century anecdote collection, that also, like, I think with 150 anecdotes in there, that is only concerned with the telegraph as such. So that, just to give you an impression that this was really a technology that kind of bothered the contemporaries, pretty much in the same way as the internet bothers us today. Okay? And one of the anecdotes goes as follows. Yeah? So there was one very, very important London businessman and a young man, and he's just been married to an attractive wife, so the anecdote goes. Yeah? And he's very important, and he's also a member of parliament, and he goes to the House of Commons, to a House of Commons sitting, and I think it really runs like that, literally. He was just about to rise and debate, so he was just about to stand up and say something terribly important, and then opens the door, and the messenger comes in and hands him a telegram. And on the telegram, it says, and I quote, and now listen very carefully, telegram from his wife, and it says, I quote, "I flee with Mr. So-and-so to Dover Strait. Pray for me." End of quote. So, yeah, that's it. I'm done. I've got this new man in my life, and I'm off. Yeah. So he was very excited, and he jumped up in the House of Commons, fled, went home, very, very agitated, and he found his wife at home knitting, pretending that nothing has happened, and he confronted her, and she said, like, "What? I just sent you a telegram, and it says, and I quote, 'I tea with Mrs. So-and-so in Dover Street. Stay for me.'" Yeah. So you just change a few letters, and the meaning is entirely different. Of course, I mean, I don't need to tell you that we have no idea whatsoever if this is made up, if this is just, an urban legend, basically. Chances are it is. But its existence itself indicates how much this the tiny misunderstandings and the tiny typos and spelling mistakes in telegrams could actually affect the meaning in telegrams. Yeah. It's, I think, pretty obvious that such plain misunderstandings also had a bearing on the sharing of knowledge as such. The relation between information and knowledge was, however, influenced in other ways as well, and this might even be more important. Due to the real, or at least the perceived, need for brevity in telegraphic communication, often only very isolated pieces of information were chosen for transmission. These were then completely stripped of any qualifying context. The telegraph and its particular rationale therefore pushed the decontextualization of information to hitherto unknown degrees. Only single selected pieces of information would be transmitted at a very high speed and then be recontextualized by the recipient, while further qualifying information, what we call the context, might either not come at all or only arrive days or weeks later, per letter, for instance. And these two phases of transition between knowledge and information and data, are thus the interfaces where the telegraph and its rationale can influence knowledge sharing processes and unfold a transformative impact on knowledge on the move. And I've originally had three examples for you to illustrate in really particular settings how this worked. I think for time reasons, I'll skip the dullest one and just stick with the first and the third. I think that should allow me to stay at least roughly in the allocated time frame. Now, the first example is the best documented, and that's also why I'll dwell a little longer on it. The last one is... No, I don't say anything on the third one. Make that a surprise. Okay. The first one is what I would call the execution of John Hutchings. Yeah? And the story goes like this. On 30 August 1847, so very, very, very early in the history of the telegraph, very initial stages, on this day, the Times of London reported extensively about judicial inquiries into a rather trivial case of poisoning. The case went as such. Mary Hutchings, she was 48 years old, and the wife of John Hutchings, who was a cooper at Deptford, she died after a lengthy and a very painful struggle, which was described in very colorful detail. She died on the evening of Sunday, the 22nd of August. Now, from witness accounts and from the post-mortem examination, which were both described, as I said, in meticulous detail, very unsavory detail in the article, it was established that the deceased had died of arsenic poisoning. Now, 16-year-old Thomas Hutchings, who was the son of her and John Hutchings, he had kept a bottle of arsenic in a locked drawer in his bedroom for the purpose of poisoning rats and cats, which, as such, was not questioned and seemed in the article and seemed to be a proper reason to have arsenic in it. In the course of inquiries, it was then established that his father, John Hutchings, had broken open the drawer at some point and taken the arsenic under the pretense, so he said, of keeping it out of reach of his wife, who was, in his account, highly suicidal and, you know, better keep the arsenic out of her touch. Yeah? Other more direct evidence against John Hutchings was scarce. Nevertheless, it was decided to put him to trial for murder, because you had witness accounts that at some point he had taken the arsenic, so it follows, we don't have any evidence for that, but it follows that he has poisoned his wife, murder, full stop. Yeah? According to the Times article, the responsible coroner said to Hutchins, and I quote, "It's my painful duty, after a most patient investigation into the whole of the evidence, to inform you that the jury, by the solemn oath they have taken, have agreed unanimously on a verdict of willful murder against you, and that you will be forthwith committed to Newgate, the prison where people are usually hanged, to stand your trial on this most serious charge." End of quote. Now, about a month later, this trial took place, and judging from the court record that I've looked at, very little new evidence was produced, so it was really only circumstantial evidence that the jury had, but nevertheless, John Hutchings was found guilty of willful murder, and he was sentenced, of course, to death. On the day of the execution at Maidstone Gaol, like a couple of, I think, 20 kilometers away from central London, however, a very, very remarkable incident took place that found its way into the London Anecdotes, again into the Anecdote collection, but not only there, it's been related in the Times of London as well, in loads of publications, so it's fairly safe historical knowledge about it. And I'll quote from this anecdote. On Thursday, the 2nd of October, 1847, a man named Hutchings was to have been executed for murder at Maidstone. But just before the appointed hour, the government sent a message by the South Eastern Telegraph to stay the execution for 2 hours. This was virtually looked upon as a reprieve, and regarding all the circumstances of the case, everybody in Maidstone considered that the man's sentence had been commuted. The sheriff was busily engaged in examining the exact character of the communication with a view, no doubt, of satisfying he was not exceeding his duty. Perplexed as to the proper course to be adopted, the sheriff in his trepidation commenced by the electric telegraph a correspondence with the Home Office to the effect that he waited for further orders. end of quote. So what has happened? Yeah, a telegraph all of a sudden out of the blue appeared in Maidstone saying, no, don't execute, please wait. Yeah? Well, this has been unheard of so far. Now, the Times also reported on the incident, and the order to stay the execution for 2 hours has apparently come directly from the Home Office. And I quote from the Times, it seems that the Under Secretary of State had been in conference with a gentleman who had interested himself in the case, and the re-examination of the evidence was humanely determined on pending the consultation the Under Secretary ordered the temporary respite. End of quote. So something wanted to reconsider if this was really proper to say that Hutchins had to be hanged. The examination was reopened, and the sheriff at Maidstone Gaol, he knew that the scarcity of non-circumstantial evidence in the case of Hutchins, he knew about this, and this explains why the re-examination of the matter on such a short notice came about, at least to the sheriff. So for the sheriff it was obvious. I mean, okay, we have something, we have a court case here that is very unclear. Now, this is the reason why they suspended the execution on such a short notice. So that was kind of the self-explanatory or the self-explanation that the sheriff came up with. But due to the brevity of the telegraphic message and the lack of background information, he was understandably confused. Only a few years after the opening of the first commercial telegraph lines in the United Kingdom, to receive such a request by telegram was more than just unusual. The sheriff was accordingly unsure as to the proper course of action, and he found himself in a state of insecurity and abeyance, and he had no practical knowledge to act on, apart from the rudimentary message to stay the execution, and of course, apart from the many connotations that the use of the telegraph as a medium in such a case carried. The Times article said that, and I quote again, an extraordinary sensation was created in Maidstone. It was generally believed that the man would not be hanged. The sheriff delayed the execution the full time of the 2 hours and did not get the second mandate ordering the execution until after the expiration of the time. End of story. Now, why is this important? Well, before we come to the explanation why it's important, I'll relate a second part of the story. Now, the sheriff didn't hear much from London for a long time, and he was utterly confused. He couldn't make head or tail of the situation. Now, why didn't he hear anything? Because, in fact, later it turned out that this re-examination of the case only took like a couple of minutes. Yeah, someone looked at it and said, like, "Oh, come on, let's hang him anyway." Yeah, and what happened was, of course, you send a second message. You send a telegraphic message. Please wait. Don't do anything. So the logical consequences. The second message says, okay, we've looked at it, it's fine, yeah, go on. You also send a telegraphic message. But this wasn't quite as easy as the first message, because what happened was the following. They sent a messenger to the Southeastern Telegraph Terminal in London. Like, so here's the message, please send this to Maidstone. And there was a very responsible young clerk sitting there, and he looked at the message. We don't know what it said exactly, but it probably said something like, please go on with the execution or something like that. Yeah? And the clerk said, sorry, can't do. Yeah? If I send this, someone will be killed and I don't have any proper authority. Because, and now that's the crucial point, a telegram, when you post a telegram, it has to be written in a particular form that makes it suitable for transmission. There is no place for a seal there. There is no place for a signature there. So you don't have any authority on this. You just have a few words on a piece of paper. And this clerk, responsible as he was, said, no, sorry. I mean, if I send this just on the authority of what stands there, I myself become the sheriff. That was his argument. I can't do that. So I'll spare you the details. A whole conundrum of things unfolded. And in the end, it ended with a couple of people from the Southeastern Railway Company going directly to the Under Secretary of State in the City of London, and having this particular form signed in the presence of witnesses and sealed, yeah, and then they took it all together to the telegraph office and sent it there. So, of course, that's not very efficient, yeah, but somehow authority had to be produced in a way that lacked, or that was utterly lacking, in this new way of communicating. And that's the 2 points that I wanted to make. I'll sum up a bit more concisely than I actually wanted to do. But that's the two things that are important about this case. Yeah? The first thing is the unexpected, well, let's say, emotions that the receiving a telegram in Maidstone evoked in the sheriff. For him, that was something I completely knew. Oh, they sent me a telegram. It means this is really important, you know? They don't send a letter, they don't send a messenger, it's a telegram. So this also relates to, that's something that I don't have here, but maybe you know that, during the Second World War, and to a certain degree also during the Vietnam War, let's say like this, for a very long time in America, receiving a telegram for common people, not for business people, but for common people, carried very, very negative connotations, because mainly the only telegrams that they would get during the Second World War or the early phases of the Vietnam War, telling them stuff like, I'm so sorry, but your son died in action in the European War Theater, something like that. For many, many people, these were the only telegrams that they would ever get, because the US Army sends such information out via telegram. So this was something that proved to be very enduring in American cultural lore, if you want to call it like that, that telegrams are very, very negatively connotated in certain contexts. And the same is here. Yeah? Receiving a telegram for the sheriff had carried connotations of urgency, of importance. Oh, wow, something really important is going to happen here. Maybe we should release him right away because this has been re-examined. Okay, so he didn't act on the information that the telegram contained as such, but he acted on all of the baggage that the information came with. So that's the one thing. And the other thing, of course, is the utter impossibility of encapsulating authority in a telegram. That was very much needed if you wanted to hang someone, obviously. Yeah? So that's the two points that I wanted to relate. and we can go into further detail if you want in a discussion. I'll skip the second example, and with the third example, I'll just read this example out without much further comment, and you will soon see, I think, where it leads. I'll just tell you, and then I'll close without saying anything else, because I think that sets the stage for a comment, I think, rather well. I'll just tell you where it comes from. It's been taken from a book by Lord Edward Cecil. It's called The Leisure of an Egyptian Official. Cecil was an official and attaché in British Egypt during the time where Egypt was not properly annexed, like not annexed for real by Great Britain, but it was a protectorate. And he was acting there in different official functions. And he wrote a very witty book about what his life was like. And one of the things that he related was a rather detailed account of a telegraphic exchange that has allegedly or not taken place during his time in office. Now, this exchange is exactly dated, and I've spent a couple of days trying to locate it in the archives, because it's utterly unclear whether this is fictional or not. Yeah? I was not successful, so I couldn't find it in the archives. That does not necessarily mean that it's been made up, but for the time being, we'll assume that it's fictional. Nevertheless, it will build on some experiences that Cecil has made during his time in the service. And from now on, I'll just quote, and then that's that. I quote, an official correspondence, 1916. January 1st, Foreign Office to Cairo. 101. Greek Prime Minister wishes to import grain. Can you do this? January 4th, Cairo to Foreign Office. 416, your 101 not understood. Where does he want to import? Is it into Egypt? January 8th, Foreign Office to Cairo, 103, Greek Prime Minister wishes to import grain into Greece. Can you do this? January 11th, Cairo to Foreign Office, 420, your 103, we have done it several times. January 12th, Foreign Office to Cairo, 108, regret copy mislaid. What is gist of my 103? If possible, repeat. January 14th, Cairo to Foreign Office. Regret copy to your 103 mislaid here. Believe it concerned Greek Prime Minister. January 16th, Foreign Office to Cairo, 108. Greek Prime Minister wishes to import grain into Greece. Can you do this? January 19th, Cairo to Foreign Office, 428, your 108. We have imported grain into Greece several times. It was believed to go to the German army. But 1916. January 22nd, Foreign Office to Cairo, 112, UFO 28. If you import grain to Greek Prime Minister, can you suggest measures to prevent its reaching the German army? Would Prime Minister's personnel guarantee be sufficient? January 24th, Cairo to Foreign Office, 430, UFO 112. Which Prime Minister's guarantee do you suggest? Prefer M. Prion, if still in office. January 27th, FO to Cairo, 114, your 430. We alluded to Greek Prime Minister. Please let me have your views as soon as possible, as matter is urgent and delay to be avoided. February 8th, Cairo to Foreign Office, 435, your 114. To avoid delay, suggest the personal guarantee in writing of Greek Prime Minister countersigned by British Consul at Piraeus with documentary assent of British government and approval, Director General Customs Administration, Alexandria. February 10th, Foreign Office to Cairo, 118, your 435, have agreed to accept joint and several guarantee of King of Greece, Archimandrite and Greek Prime Minister countersigned by leading British merchant at Piraeus, Mr. Carl Sonnenschein. How much can you send? February 13th, Cairo to Foreign Office, 440, your 118, will reply as soon as possible, but some delay inevitable, as uncertain what department of the Egyptian government deals with these questions. Have so far unsuccessfully inquired of main drainage, public instruction, war office, agriculture, public works, and WAQF. Will wire again later. March 23rd, Cairo to Foreign Office, 150, regret delaying answer to your 118, matter very complicated, your 487, naval authorities object, export of seed, as many seeds contain oil suitable for submarines. Can you arrange with Admiralty? 495, your 150, have arranged with Admiralty, seed will be escorted by two destroyers. Now we get to the climax. March 28th, Foreign Office to Cairo, 499, my 495, have a certain seat question less important than at first considered. Greek Prime Minister has written, explaining seat is needed for his favorite parrot, who is of great age and delicate. 2 pounds of selected will be sufficient. Please obtain and send. Admiralty consider escort unnecessary under circumstances. March 31st, Cairo to Foreign Office, 161, your 499, am obtaining seed at once. Can you inform me of approximate size of parrot? Yes. Understand from inquiries that there is a direct relation between size of bird and size of food seeds. April 7th, Foreign Office to Cairo, 406, your 161, stop seed. April 8th, Cairo to Foreign Office, 165, your 506, seed stopped. April 12th, Foreign Office to Cairo, 510, your 165, as information has reached me that the Greek Prime Minister's parrot died last week of indigestion, no further matter. In necessary. Thank you very much.